wants to warm up. Let's warm up.
Hello and welcome to Liberty Southwest podcast number 51. Today is April 1st, 2015. And no, this is not an April Fool's joke. We're going to be talking about first world problems. Taxes! How many taxes do you pay and where do they go? That's what we're going to talk about today. I'm joined by Eric Tiller and I am Matt Winter. Chelsea Kimbo may be joining us off and on. She's having some network issues. We've had some rolling storms running through. It actually ruined our first take of the podcast. We were about 15 minutes in and we're ready to go again. Eric, how you doing?
Doing well.
That's fantastic.
We're
talking about taxes. How much do we pay in taxes tonight? And Eric brought up this awesome website, nowinfutures.com/taxes.html. And we started going over that. Eric, you want to go over that again?
Sure. I think the topic really came up last week. After the show, we were discussing it's tax season after all, kind of, and I threw out the thought that, you know, how much do we really pay? Does anybody really think about that? You don't hear that conversation too often. And did a little research, and turns out, you know, average, first of all, less than half the population pays an income tax. Obviously, you pay taxes on, you know, you pay sales taxes, you pay the various excise taxes, et cetera, but the income tax, a good portion of the population gets tax credits, and that's taken care of. But the total percent for a taxpayer who does pay in average is 58.5%, which is a fair amount, don't you think, Matt?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was saying this earlier. I am in one of the higher tax brackets, but I don't have any write-offs. I don't own a home. I really don't have any ability to knock down what I pay in personal income taxes. And as a result, I end up paying a whole lot of my money into the federal government and state government and sales tax and all of those good things. And I think paying in 58% of your income is, you know, it's a little ridiculous, to be honest. When you think about that overall, that's a, you know, it's certainly not a revenue problem in this country, I think, is probably one of the best ways to put it. There's plenty of revenue there. They just spend way too damn much of it. Mm-hmm.
I would agree with that, and it's unfortunate when people think about taxes, a lot of people just focus on that one number, that federal income tax number, and they don't really realize that we're paying taxes in so many different ways, and some of it's very direct. We see sales tax itemized on receipts, but we don't really understand the full scope of how much money we're paying in taxes when we figure that our rent payments, if we're renters, that includes we have to pay for the owner's property taxes, right? So that's built into the cost of our rent. And built into the cost of every single product we buy are the taxes that those organizations have to pay as well. So, I mean, I think that 58% is actually a little bit higher when you factor in the fact that the cost of goods and services are higher because those entities also have to pay tax. And in order for them to pay tax, they have to build it into the price of the product. And I mean, the fact that, you know, even if we say we're at like 58%, that means that you're working all the way through June. All of that was for free. All of that work you did, you don't start putting money in your pocket until July. I mean, that's crazy.
And I think you, this was our second attempt at the podcast. The last go around, I think you came on and you didn't completely hear what we're covering, and there is some conversation around FICA. But the numbers off of nowinfutures.com/taxes.html kind of break down, and this is average, 17% for federal personal income tax, 10.1% for state and local income tax, 9.7% for sales tax. That's all sales tax. So it would be municipal, state, et cetera. There's no federal at this point. 7.65% for Social Security and Medicare. 2.5% for federal and state corporate income tax. 2.5% for property tax, which you alluded to, Chelsea, is it's kind of a pass-through on your rent that you have to cover. Or, you know, property owners or renters, either way, you're going to have to pay for that. 0.5% for fuel and gasoline, and then 6% for other, which includes estate tax, fees, licenses, real inflation losses, inheritance, deficit allowance, gift, and others. And I think that's a key. Inflation losses is between what's actually accounted for by the U.S. government, between 2 and 4% a year, devaluing of the currency. And I think before the podcast here, Chelsea, you're also referencing Social Security and Medicare, which, if you count what the company that your employer takes care of, is actually 15.3%, because the employers have to match the individual tax, right?
Well, exactly. So it's 50% paid by the employer and 50% paid by the employee. And that's a real cost for people to employ you. So if I want to pay you $100, I actually have to pay $107.65. And that extra, you know, 7.65%, I could be giving to you, but instead I've got to be paying that for the match for Social Security and Medicare. So it's really 15.3. So we could tack onto that 58 another 7.65 as far as I'm concerned.
Right.
You know, not to mention, you know, unemployment taxes, both state and federal. I mean, there's just a multitude of different ways in which we pay taxes. And I feel like people don't get as upset or outraged by the amount of taxes that we pay, because we don't have a really good grasp on what that percentage is, because it's spread out in all these different ways. And some ways are very direct and we see them on our pay stub. And in some ways they're very indirect, such as the, you know, things built into the cost of the product. So like there are really high taxes built into the price of like liquor, for example, or cigarettes. Instead of having an itemized portion on the receipt, like we see with sales tax, those taxes are built into the listed price of the item. So right. There's a lot of ways that they can almost hide how much taxes we're really paying. So people don't really, you know, they might think and focus on that federal income tax rate and go, oh, well, I'm at 15%. That's not so bad. I can manage that. But they're not adding in all of the different ways that we pay taxes and coming up with a number and realizing that they're working 5, 6, 7 months out of the year for free, essentially.
And I think that's the reason why we wanted to bring this up, because of the fact that so rarely do you hear, you know, even when it's tax season, you hear people talk about the full measure of how they're taxed. You know, right now we're at 59 to 70%, depending on the metric that that's used, and it's high, but it's not the highest in the world. The United States, by any stretch, isn't the highest in the world. But I think an interesting thought is, you know, first of all, I think the premise of the podcast tonight was to understand what's being paid, and then what it's being used for, and maybe, you know, what is there an inflection point where the general population, you know, the tax paying population, says, you know what, this is too much, it's too high. And I think, to a certain extent, the movement has changed, but that was kind of the genesis behind the Tea Party movement. Acronym T stands for Taxed Enough Already. And the Tea Party movement was actually an offspring of Ron Paul's Campaign for Liberty in 2017, 2018. It was hijacked by the establishment Republicans and really is nothing like how it was or how it was actually originally formed.
Wait, what years did you just say?
Did I say 17? I
mean, yeah.
2007. Sorry.
Yeah. I just time warp?
I'm from the future. Yeah, 2007. So mid-December 2007. So, you know, there are people who are enraged, but I think they're somewhat of a minority. Most people, because of just the way taxes are imposed, and it's kind of incrementally, and I think you could argue that it's a lot of taxes are kind of a stealth. People don't think about it. Like there's a sales tax, you know, when you're at a restaurant, or sales tax and purchasing different services, or, you know, a county or municipal tax on alcohol or various services. And it just kind of just all adds up.
Right. Yeah. And when you're
absolutely,
it's disconcerting. It really bugs the crap out of me because you sit there and you try to create this budget for what you can live on. And you do it under this false pretense that you're making a certain amount that you bring home weekly, but you're getting screwed out of so much more. Your money could go so much further without this terrible burden that the government likes to place on you.
Well,
I was going to say they can't even keep the power grid up, even though they subsidize the crap out of that.
Yeah. I always thought it was a fun exercise when I would, I used to teach. And whenever I would teach a payroll accounting class, I would, you know, ask the student, you know, we'd learn how to calculate FICA taxes and we'd learn how to calculate, you know, federal unemployment and state unemployment and, you know, withholding taxes. And so I'd leave it up to the students. I'd say, okay, now just make up a paycheck and then we'll calculate the taxes. We'll figure out, okay, here's the gross pay and here's the net pay, you know, what you take home after everything's said and done. And so inevitably the students would, you know, make up some fantastical, this huge salary amount, like, right? Like they'd be dreaming like, okay, we're going to make $10,000 every 2 weeks. And I was like, okay, so let's do the math, okay? So we calculate the federal withholding and the state withholding and all the FICA taxes, and we get to the net pay for that paycheck, and we calculate the employer contributions. And they were astonished. I remember specifically one student, I mean, they saw this $10,000 paycheck, and to them they're going like, oh, my God, that's so much money. What a rich person, you know? And they saw that $10,000 get like cut down like in half. And they're like, oh my God, I almost feel bad for this person. Like, it's just crazy. It kind of just blew their minds. And that's just, you know, a fraction of the taxes that we pay. That's just, you know, payroll related taxes.
Absolutely.
And I think that it would be, I think people's jaws would drop. I think people would be outraged if we could do that same thing, but spread it to all of the taxes. If we could see a comprehensive tax bill, I think people would be pissed. I think they'd say, no, government, you need to live within your budget because we're giving you more than enough to make this work. And there's absolutely no reason, there's no excuse that you need to be lending on top of that. You know, there's just absolutely no reason that we're paying this much money and getting what for it and getting where.
So I always love how I bring out this conversation with people, and they generally, people know I'm a libertarian, they know where I'm coming from, and I always love when I bring it up and they bring up, oh, well, the homeland defense budget, that's the defense budget, it's a homeland security, it's all, yeah, you know what, I disagree with that spending too, so welcome to my bandwagon. You know, it's very frustrating. You know, you try to bring up it's social services. There's a huge amount of money that goes into social services. So you see, it's not considered redistribution of wealth, but it absolutely is what it is. I pay in a ton of taxes. Other people collect money from those taxes. And on top of that, we borrow to make things make ends meet. And it's just I get so frustrated when I talk about this.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess what we can say is that it's not a sustainable system, and there's no, I don't think that there's any excuse for us to be operating this way. And I think the only reason that it's been allowed to go on for so long is because there's a shifty maneuvering of the ways in which we pay taxes. So people aren't as outraged because they don't see 58%. They don't see 70%. 70% of their money going to taxes. They don't see that. It's a little bit here. It's a little bit there. It's a little bit over there. It's a little bit here and here and here. So they don't realize the full scope of our taxation. And if they don't feel it, they're not as outraged. And I feel like it was designed that way. I really do. I really believe it was designed so that they could, you know, maximize the amount of taxes they receive without, you know, with us, you know, not realizing exactly what that number is.
Absolutely. I completely agree. Well, if they made it obvious how much you were spending in taxes, if they did like a truth in taxation bill that said, this is literally what you're paying for all the time. This is how much you're paying in taxes. Like every receipt was required to show how much you paid in taxes. Well, they already do. Hang on a second. That doesn't make sense. Anyway, if there's like a truth in taxation that showed how much of your income was going to taxes every year, in addition to your income taxes that you file at the end of the year, people would be irate.
I would agree. You know, it would almost be cool, like, if we think about things in terms of, like, when I buy something, like, let's say I get my electricity bill every month. I send them a check, and they show me exactly what I'm paying for. I get an invoice that says, this is what you're paying for. You use X amount of electricity, and this is how much it costs you. Wouldn't it be amazing if, like, every month or once a year or something, we essentially get an invoice from the government saying, this is how much you paid in taxes, and this is where we spent your money. This is where it's going to. You're paying X amount of dollars for defense. You're paying X amount of dollars for Social Security and da-da-da-da-da-da, financing of debt, education. And then we could, like, see, you know, and maybe if it was more real, if it was less abstract, people would start to go, hey, we need to change this. This isn't okay. Like, why am I paying this much for X, Y, or Z?
And you don't, in the context of local, state, or federal taxes, you don't see an itemized breakdown as to how your tax dollar is used. And I have to imagine, and this is probably an area where you're much more aware, Chelsea, than either Matt or I, that there have been initiatives put forward, because if you look at a typical bill, your utility bill or a cable bill or any, you know, a credit card bill or whatever, you typically do see a breakdown in what you're paying for. But with taxes, you don't receive it unless you really look, right? You could argue, well, somebody from the government government side, IRS or state tax departments or local tax departments, you can say, well, this is all available on website X, Y, or Z, but it's not easily found, I don't think, to the average, you know, the average mm-hmm. person.
Right. And well, and the other piece of that too, so like I think you sent out a link and it kind of showed the breakdown of federal spending, but it's almost a little misleading because they might say, oh, well, we spend, you know, 20% of all of the money that we spent on, you know, like Medicare, for example.
Sure.
But they don't show how much of that is administrative, you know, so how much of that, you know, is actually spent on, you know, the government jobs and administering the program versus the benefits that are being provided to people. I mean, what if, you know, that 20% of all the money that they spend in a year, what if 10% of that is just to administer the program and only 10 of that, you know, goes to the actual people who need it? You know, so there's not, I mean, maybe if we did some more digging, maybe we could find that somewhere. But it's, I don't think the average person is going to really be digging that far to see, and I don't know how much they, you know, they're not going to put in a line item for administrative redundancy. you know.
And I think it's been pretty well documented. There's some pretty good movie documentaries as well as articles and books out there. If you want to specifically dive into education as an example, administrative costs or the higher tier jobs absorb a lot of the funding for, if you want to specifically talk about Department of Education, public school districts, et cetera. And just based on that knowledge, I'd really have to believe that's the case for the majority of government agencies, where you have a ton of administrative overhead that isn't really accounted for or made publicly available, right?
Right. So they say, this is how much we spent on Social Security. It's like, okay. And people would automatically think that's how much, you know, people are receiving in benefits, when in fact it might be only a very small portion of that dollar amount that's going to the actual purpose of providing benefits, as opposed to administering the program and the bureaucracy itself. And it's interesting. Oh, so I used to work at a nonprofit, and one thing that's really common with people when they think about nonprofits is how much actually goes to the service itself as opposed to the administration of the nonprofit. Like, this is a really big thing on people's minds. They think, well, if I'm going to donate my money to this charity or this nonprofit, I want, you know, my dollars to really go to the cause. You know, if I donate to the Red Cross, I want it to be helping people who need to be helped. I don't want it to go into administration overhead. But the funny thing is we don't really think that same way when we think about our taxes, which is bizarre. For me, it's like, if I'm going to, you know, I have no problem paying taxes to help people out who need it. I really don't. I mean, but at the same time, I don't want to be feeding the monster that is our overgrown government. Mm-hmm. And so if I'm paying money to help people out who really need it, that's where I want my money to go. And like you said, with the Department of Education, a majority of it goes to, you know, superintendents and people in big cushy offices, not the teachers. We know that the teachers aren't, you know, out there rolling in Benzes, you know, they're not going to provide the best, you know, buildings and curriculums. That's not where it's going. It's administration. And I think that's bullshit. You know, I think that we definitely need more visibility in that area. And with visibility, maybe some accountability can come along with that.
And my question, I mean, legislatively, I don't think, you know, maybe Chelsea, Matt, I'm not aware of legislative initiatives to bring transparency into government functionality or accounting administration.
You're asking the government to be self-accountable in this,
right?
So, right. I mean, that's not going to happen,
right? And that's kind of where I'm going with the thought is, sure. So there is a spending problem, there is a tax problem, but there is also a system in place that has a vested interest in self-preservation that has, you know, politically has probably the most to lose. So how do you crack that nut? How do you get more transparency? I'm sure you see politicians running on, you know, we're going to bring more transparency into government spending or that type of thing, but that's not something, at least in my eyes, that's readily available at this point.
I think you're spot on with that, and I think the real question is, how could we end up passing legislation that would provide that transparency? What would be the requirement in order to make people want to see that transparency? I think it starts at a more base level. Meaning,
well, it starts with financial pain on enough right. people where there's political action, right? Isn't that basically, isn't that the impetus that would be required?
You would have to have a pain point, just like in sales. You know, you sell to a pain point.
Mm-hmm.
You'd have to emphasize that pain point and make people recognize that it was there. Right now, people don't realize how much they spend on taxes. There's no way. I mean, there are a significant portion of the population who do know how much they're spending in taxes, but I would imagine that the vast majority And I say significant portion, I mean, there's millions of people, but there's, you know, 200 and some odd million people in this country. I would imagine that the vast majority of them do not have any understanding. And if they did feel that pain, if you turned on, you know, NBC and it was prime time and they had a expose on how much everybody pays in taxes, it would be an uproar.
I agree. And I think that, you know, I think you're right. If we were ever to have any success in, you know, putting pressure on the government for more transparency, I think it does come from people, you know, asking that of government by really getting passionate about it and demanding it, you know, putting that political pressure on, you know, so maybe somebody says, you know, this is going to be part of my campaign. This is going to be something that I am going to push for then, because I see that there are, you know, X amount of people out here who are demanding transparency, you know, so maybe that's where it comes from. The more cynical part of me thinks that, you know, even if you demand transparency, they could provide it in such a way that you're still not seeing where that unnecessary spending or administrative redundancies are coming from. You know, they might say, well, it's X amount of dollars for this program, without specifying how much of that is administrative or unnecessary. And it's kind of interesting. I mean, I've had a couple glimpses into, you know, some of the programs. So I worked with, and still do work with, some people who receive veteran, you know, disability payments, Social Security, social supplemental income, you know, some people in a group home that are, you know, mentally disabled and have been for their whole lives, will be for the rest of their lives. And so I work with a social worker in Lee Seward County, and, you know, they have to constantly be, you know, monitoring their income and expenses to make sure that they stay qualified for certain, you know, programs. And it's ridiculous, some of the requirements and rules and how they operate is just silly. And the amount of time that's spent tracking these items and making sure that they fall in line with these specific criteria, it's just insane. I mean, it should be simple. Here's someone who is born with a diagnosis of moderate or profound mental retardation. They are going to need assistance and care for the rest of their lives, period. Mm-hmm. So why don't you just say, okay, here you go. We're going to be paying for, you know, your group home. We're going to make sure that you have housing, food, you know, medical insurance, period. But yet there's all of these different differentiations in terms of whether it's this funding stream or that funding stream. So some of them get what's called GRH, which is group residential housing. So the county will pay a portion of their room and board. And then some of them get social supplemental income, which is different from Social Security. And then some of them get both Social Security and social supplemental income. And then some people get a VA pension because of like a family related thing. But if their like assets reach more than $2,000, then suddenly, you know, they're disallowed from receiving a certain kind of benefit, and they have to reduce their monthly benefits by X amount of dollars for 12 months until their assets get below a certain limit. But if you buy a prepaid burial account, that doesn't count against it. And it gets so complicated. So unnecessarily complicated. I can't tell you how many jobs and how many hours are spent dealing with these ridiculous fucking rules. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. It should be, like, so easy. Here's someone who needs their help. Okay, let's just make sure that their medical care is taken care of, their room board's taken care of, that they've got food, and that they're happy and healthy. Like, we don't need all of these little if, but, and, you know, and by doing so, the administrative costs are inherently, you know, just through the roof, because we create these super complex rules around, well, if this, then that. And it's like, and what's crazy is that these eight ladies are all in basically the same boat, but they all are treated differently somehow. And for basically no reason. Like one of them, like one of the rules is that, so like they go to like a work training center during the day where they might make, you know, $1 or $5 every 2 weeks. But then if they make more than $60 a month, they become ineligible for certain benefits, but then they also become eligible for other benefits. Like, it's just this crazy, crazy system. And this is just for, like, Social Security and Medicare benefits. God knows about all the other programs out there.
Yeah, my mom is deeply ingrained in that system. She's been doing assisted living help for a very long time, and she certainly doesn't do it for the money. Those guys make crap for money. I mean, you can make more than what my mom makes working at McDonald's. Literally, you can.
Yeah, and it's sad. And I mean, that's where the money should be going, is to providing quality of care, right?
So, in your opinion, why... The first thoughts that popped in my head when talking about this is these are organizations that are in need of streamlining and have probably administrative overlap and have been around for a long time. They've had their process in place for a long time, and there has been absolutely no business optimization performed in probably years, right? You basically have organizational rot in place because of the fact that they're government bureaucracy. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't that be the case?
A lot of them are private companies that operate as a government arm, I guess. Mm-hmm. They get most of their funding from the government, and that's how they operate. And the people who lead these organizations... there's several around the Twin Cities. One's like MRCI. There's... Mm-hmm. On all of it, Rolling Acres, there's a couple others out there, but they all kind of operate in the same way, where they are looking to turn a profit because it is a for-profit company, so they will do whatever they can to make as much money as they can, and that includes, you know, underpaying their employees. And then it's also, on top of that, their raises and their bonus structure are all mandated by state regulation.
And that's insane. You have, like, private organizations, and some of them are nonprofit, some of them are for-profit. I believe Mora, Mount Olivet, I believe Mora is a nonprofit, but some of them are for-profit, some of them are nonprofit. My dad owns a couple group homes, and he's a for-profit. But you have a situation where there are some state-run facilities, and then there are some private facilities. So in the state-run facilities, they budget in like $20 an hour for their staff. But for the private organizations, they can only afford, you know, maybe $10, $12 an hour based on the budgets that they're given. They give, like, you know, almost double the budget for a state-run facility, and it costs twice as much, or if not more, to the taxpayer for a state-run facility as it does a private organization.
Now, and that's a slippery slope to me, because I think, like we talked about just a couple weeks ago when we had our discussion on corporations and how they are beholden to make as much profit for their shareholders as possible, you get into major problems, especially, like, it's a horrible comparison, but the prison system, you look at how for-profit companies have made the prison system a nightmare in the United States. I think the same thing kind of happens with the for-profit organizations that are making money off of government contracts in the home care industry as well.
But see, here's what's different, I think, in terms of just what I've seen. So back in the day, all adults with developmental disabilities, you know, mental retardation, autism, all of those things, were housed in the state hospitals.
Right.
And I think that, you know, and back in the day, it cost, like, I don't know, $500 a day or more. And that was back in those days of prices, to provide services to a person. And you put them in a private facility and cost half as much. And so, I mean, so that just immediately tells me, okay, why does it cost so much more to provide something in an institution that's state-run as opposed to private? Now, the other piece of that, and I think that, you know, maybe you're kind of going towards this, is, hey, quality of care. Are we going to be sacrificing quality of care by profit motive if we have something that's privately held, for profit, right? Well, the issue there is that the accountability comes in with licensing, making sure that the standards are up to par. So when it comes to like medication administration, making sure that there aren't med errors and the follow, you know, specific procedures have to be followed, you know, and there's a bunch of licensing that you have to go through and reviews that you have to go through to ensure that you're providing services according to the quality of care standards set by the state. And then the state then is also accountable to the federal government for any federal funds that it receives via, you know, Medicare or Social Security. So I think that there are controls like that in place. And on top of that, in the past several years, there's even been some talk about the state totally getting out of the home health care because they've seen tragedy after tragedy in the state-run facilities. For example, I believe this was about 3 years ago, a woman died in the bathtub from drowning in a state-run facility because the phone rang and the person went, took the phone call, completely forgot that she had a client in the bathtub and she drowned. You know, so I think you're going to see tragedy, you know, just because something doesn't have a profit motive doesn't mean that the quality of care is going to be inherently better.
No, I think shifting gears a little bit here. I totally agree with everything that you're saying, but I think we're getting slightly off topic.
I do have a.
Go ahead.
I have a libertarian stance on this, and interested. You know, we can move forward, but in situations like we're talking about, so mental health facilities, senior citizen homes, hospice, that type of thing. I think a lot of libertarians would say, well, why is the state involved at all? This should be a voluntary charity type of situation where, you know, these organizations are not run for a profit. They're run not as a state organization, a state or a federal government organization, but they're run as a charity. Why can't that work? And probably there's just not enough. At this point, there isn't enough money to finance those types of organizations, right?
Well, and maybe part of that is because we're giving, you know, 60% of our income to the government.
Well, maybe if
we weren't paying so much in taxes,
are financed by
we could afford to give more to charitable organizations.
Yeah.
I think that's a completely legitimate thing to say. I completely agree.
I guess the whole reason I kind of went down that path is just to exemplify my personal experience with the inefficiencies of publicly run institutions as opposed to privately run institutions.
Right.
Yeah, and the same thing, I think if you were to dive into VA hospitals, you'd hear a lot of the same type of rhetoric from people who participated in that. And that's... They certainly could be run more efficiently, and they probably could be run more efficiently outside of the scope of government. And it's whether or not there's an appetite to do that, and there may or may not be. But kind of getting back on track, I think that's what Matt was looking to do, or it's all the same track, I guess. I'm going to kind of go over that link I shared or I included on the in the show notes is a Forbes link that breaks down. You know, we've talked about how the fact that federal income tax dollars are certainly not the only type of dollars that are paid or spent, but that's the most visible for a lot of people. And the way that breaks down, the two most notable are Social Security, 24%. Medicare and Medicaid, 22%. I think a lot of people think about defense, but it's not the highest at 19%. Safety net programs, which I think we're just kind of talking about, at 12%. Retirement for federal employees and vets, 8%. Interest on the debt, 6%. Transportation infrastructure, which is somewhat ironic, is at 3%. And I think a lot of people would agree that's probably one of the primary purposes of government would be defense and defense transportation infrastructure. Science and medical research at 2%. Education, according to this graphic, is only at 1%. And international aid, 1%. So the big categories that really affect, you know, us, or, you know, those Medicare and Medicare, Medicaid and Social Security programs, which I think a lot of people believe are unfunded liabilities as well, right?
Absolutely. Especially as we are heading into a time where the baby boomer generation is going to be retiring, we're going to see a huge uptick in the amount of spending that's going to have to happen in those areas, and it's got to come from a smaller population. So how do you sustain that? It's completely unfunded.
Yeah, I think most our age don't think that probably will. I mean, we're going to have to live into our 80s to take advantage of any of that stuff.
I have no expectation to see any Social Security in my lifetime.
Yeah, I don't expect it.
I just assume that there's not going to be anything there.
Yeah, I think I don't either. I mean, most people aren't going to live in their 80s, so I was being kind of tongue-in-cheek on that.
Yeah, but I mean, the whole way that it's structured itself is, you know, just inherently flawed. I mean, if you think about it, you know, it's you know, what is the phrase? Like borrowing from Peter to pay Paul or something like that? You know, because we're not, like, so when we pay into our Social Security, we're not paying, you know, they're not putting it in a savings account for us and collecting interest on it and then saving it for when we retire. You know, they're using the funds that we pay to pay for the liabilities that have already been created for the generation that's in front of us. And that's ultimately flawed.
Right. It's a government-enforced Ponzi scheme.
It is. That's exactly what it is. I mean, so whenever you have a fluctuation in population, that's when you're going to have an issue. So we had the big baby boomer population, so Social Security and Medicare seemed to work just fine because there were a ton of people paying into it. But then if you have a constriction of population like we've seen, now you have a small amount of people that are paying for a much larger population, and the math just doesn't work. It doesn't work. It doesn't work by any means. I mean, just thinking about the way that it's structured, it's not going to work whenever you have constrictions and expansions in population. It's going to screw up that Ponzi scheme. And I don't understand why this wasn't a foreseeable consequence.
I think their expectation in the beginning was that population would continue to increase.
Well, that and when these programs, specifically Social Security and Medicare, Medicaid, people didn't take advantage of them for very long. They didn't live as long as they do now, and they didn't tap the reserves for. I mean, it was for a year or two. Most people are dead before they had a chance to collect. And you know, we live in a different time. Probably the three of us will, you know, odds are we'll live into our 80s, and right now the system structured for us to collect in the mid 60s, and that's going to change. That's going to have to change. And from what I see, the problem with streamlining or modifying Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid, and at the state level, welfare programs take up the most chunk of the tax dollar as well, is the fact that a good portion of people who vote are in the age groups that collect these benefits. So it makes it very politically, almost politically impossible to do any type of reform, because the people that's going to most affect will not vote for the people who want to reform the
right
programs.
Okay. Right, exactly.
They have a vested interest in ensuring that they get theirs. They're going to make sure to vote that way, you know, and when you have a vested interest, they're going to make sure they show up at the polls.
And the people,
versus the people who are 18, 19, who don't really
get
into politics or care that much.
And the irony is it affects them the most. The people who are most interested in entitlements, of course, they're going to go out and pull the levers, and the people who don't really, they're somewhat apathetic or don't understand how this is actually going to affect them. You know, they don't think it's cool, or they don't think their vote matters, but they're going to end up, you know, paying for it, essentially.
Absolutely.
For it and not really getting anything in return.
Well, and, you know, one thing that I've often dreamed about, like, see, this would be my utopia. Let's say we take that 15.3% of Social Security and Medicare that we're sort of told is for us, for, like, I'm paying for my retirement, right? Could you imagine how, like, if I took, you know, 15.3%, so 7.65% of my gross pay, and then the additional 7.65% that the employer pays, which for me, having my own company, I pay the full 15.3%, which I should mention. Self-employed individuals pay the full amount, the 15.3%. If you could take 15.3% of all of your wages and stick it into a money market account or a savings account, some sort of interest-bearing investment, for the until you're age 65, could you imagine how much money would be in that account when you retired? It would be insane. You would be like rich, living on the freaking Riviera in your retirement. I mean, I can't even imagine how much money would be if I actually got back dollar for dollar with interest of all the money that I paid in. Could you imagine what that would be like?
Yeah, it would be that. And essentially, where you're talking about, and that's kind of vilified when talking about Social Security, is privatizing Social Security. That's what you're doing when you're not paying FICA. You're privatizing. You're doing with that money what you want. You know, if it's through a government investment account or through a personal investment account, I think. I don't think there's enough education or appetite for that, you know, for that to take place at this point. But I think within libertarian circles, and I think that's kind of an advantage or an ace in the hole that the liberty movement has, is that more and more young people are waking up to the fact that, hey, things like keeping 15% of my tax dollars and doing with, you know, either investing or doing whatever I want with it is probably better than, you know, throwing it into a program that isn't going to have an immediate or any type of payoff.
Yeah, I agree. I think that it would be exciting if we could get to a point where we had an option. So, like, okay, so I have a friend who is a pastor, and there are a few exceptions to the FICA mandatory enrollment. And if you are a member of the clergy, you know, so like if you're a pastor or a preacher or something like that, you're not required to participate in Medicare or Social Security. You get the option to opt in. Now, here's how it works. So you have the option to opt in. If you take the option to participate, you can't ever withdraw it. So once you're in, you're in. But if you say, you know what, no, I'm going to take care of my own retirement and things like that, you can do so. I had a friend who, when I met him, it was his first year, you know, working as a pastor, and he's like, you know, should I do this or not? And we sat down and did the math together, and I'm like, I am so envious of you that you have this option. Mm-hmm. So he got to choose to not participate in the FICA program, and he gets to take that money and put it away for his own retirement. He gets to be the driver for, you know, his well-being and his financial future. And that is just amazing. I'm so jealous, and I tell him that all the time. I just wish we all had that luxury to choose whether or not to participate.
What do you have to do to qualify for this?
Yeah, I was going to ask you. Hey, do you have to be a pastor and a part of a religious institution? How does that work?
So you have to be like a member of the clergy, I think is like the terminology they use. So he's a pastor at a church.
So if I was a member of a clergy of my own church, could I claim my other income and do the same thing?
The church of
That's a great question. It might be just off the earnings from the church itself.
That's got some really good
to where you can choose to opt in or out. That might be the case. Okay. I'd have to do a little bit more research.
So what I'm hearing here is the religious lobby has done some good things for those guys.
Oh, yes. And it's kind of interesting seeing some of these loopholes for specific professions and kind of understanding the historical context. So, like, there are a bunch of different loopholes and exclusions for railroad workers, for example. And so you think about it, at the time that the programs came out, who were the real, like, power players at the time the programs were being rolled out, and then seeing how that had an effect on the tax code and who was who had the ability to exclude themselves. So there are a bunch of different exclusions for railroad workers because that was a big time industry at the time. Huh. You know, so railroad workers, clergy members, things like that. It's really actually kind of interesting.
So what I'm hearing is we need to get accountants and IT people together, and we need to start funding our own lobby.
Yeah, it's
exactly.
In politics, it's about your lobby. It's how much worth, all political and financial worth, all you have. And I think those are two examples, prime examples that, you know, where you're talking about if you have good people in place that are going to modify tax law, you're going to be able to benefit. That's pretty much what that is, isn't it, Chelsea?
Oh, I would say so. I mean, I'm sure they, you know, at the time these were passed, they had some smart people at the helm going like, whoa, 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 we need to get our people in there to make sure that we're taken care of, and we need to make sure that this doesn't apply to us and find some way to make that happen.
Right.
Yeah. So I have a question for you guys as we're kind of pulling up on an hour. So obviously you'd like to see taxes go down, see government spending go down. I kind of went over that list of things, at least at a federal level, and it's to a lesser extent matches at a state level. Do you think, without the pain, if we're just talking about the political process, do you think there are going to be any reforms that are affected by political parties or movements or anything along those lines that will reduce things like Social Security and Medicare, Medicaid, and other larger expenses? Or are we just basically looking, you know, at a situation where these programs are going to have to become insolvent, and that'll be?
I think absolutely not. I don't think there's going to be any changes that come along to slow this bullet train to hell down.
Yeah.
I think it's going to take them becoming insolvent to the point where they're completely incapable of supporting themselves before they're going to go anywhere.
Yeah, because, I mean, if you look at the list, really, from a person's perspective, like the three of us, probably things that we aren't going to see, you can quickly lop off a lot of tax dollars. We're probably not going to see Social Security. That's 24%. Probably won't take advantage of Medicare or Medicaid for very long. That's 22%. And then we have defense spending, and we haven't even really gone into that. The United States spends more on defense than the rest of the world combined. And of course there's all the entangling alliances, foreign conflicts that the U.S. is involved in that shouldn't be.
Oh, yeah.
Funny how they call it defense. I mean, I'd call it more offense.
Yeah, no, the offensively defensive.
Proactively defensive. So you have
so
that.
The whole defense budget is kind of funny to me.
Yeah, really
yeah. Not entirely true.
Yeah, so, I mean, we go 24 cents on the dollar for Social Security, 22 cents on the dollar for Medicare, 19 cents on the dollar for defense. That could probably be cut conservatively in half, if not more, on the defense side. So you have, and then you have safety net programs, which are 12%. And I think people kind of harp on that even, but that's I think to some extent, some people need some help. But, you know, it's measuring the requirements. Then at 8% is retirement for federal employees and vets, and that's the bloat. There is so huge that's not even funny. Most federal employees especially federal employees go out with 80 to 100% pensions when they're done working.
Right.
You know, so you could, I mean, conservatively, you should be able to just lock, because of us in the private sector, we don't get any of that. We get 0%. You should be able to, you know, really lop off almost that total 8%. And we talk about interest on the debt, which is 6%, but that's still not that high. And that rate would go down substantially if we didn't have the higher percentage items. And then as you go down, I think one of the true good purposes of government is transportation and infrastructure. And that's only 3%. Near, you know, science with 2% and education with 1%. But I mean, I see if you just slice what you what should be sliced, you're hitting between 60% and 70% of tax dollars that could be cut initially, you know, right away without affecting the majority of the population.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's insane. It's out of control. I would agree. I mean, if you took that defense budget and really just said, okay, we're just going to pay for actual defense measures, and then, you know, if we really looked at what is the function of the government, what is its true purpose, what is appropriate for them to entangle themselves in, we could easily cut, you know, our taxes in half. There would be some pains in doing so, and I think that's part of the hardest, that's probably the hardest part of doing so, is that, you know, there's that pain of, well, jobs are going to be lost.
Yeah.
You know, people's lives are going to be affected. But I think that, you know, temporary pains, you know, that will smooth itself out. You know, and I think I've said this before, human capital is so valuable. Why would we waste, you know, people's value in doing things that are unnecessary? They might lose their job, but instead they can find another place to put their energy and efforts into something of value for this world. You know, instead of being wasted on something that is unnecessary. I don't know. I think that the temporary pain will smooth itself out, but that's the hardest part of getting anything changed, is knowing that it will be painful at first. But if we can take a little bit of pain in order to get a greater long-term payoff and keep our eyes on the prize, I think that's where it's at.
I think if we can lower the cost of healthcare, see income security disappear a little bit, Social Security be chopped in half, and we'd see our net interest go down to a much lower amount, see some damn fine changes in this country.
It'll be interesting to see how that shapes, how that flushes out as time goes on, and say entitlements. A lot of those entitlements get, they're just available to less and less. You'd have to think that there might be some political action, but very well could turn out like you're talking about, Matt, where it'll just be a situation of insolvency before anything actually is corrected, but hopefully that's not the case.
Right on. This has been Liberty Southwest podcast number 51. Today is April 1st, 2015. This has been Eric Taylor, Chelsea Como, myself, Matt Winter. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Adios, mofo.